but dead with Trump. Nevertheless, the born and bred New Yorker was not one to give up. Trump was at this thing until the end. Chapter 14. The Race to the Bottom. Donald Trump is the Tom Brady of presidential politics, the best big game fourth quarter player in politics, bar none. Before the second presidential debate in St. Louis on October 9th, the media had already decided that the race was over. In a football game, this would be like the fourth quarter, and Trump was way behind to start it. The pressure that was mounting was crushing as Republican after Republican was urging Trump to withdraw for the good of the party. The Democrats were rolling out heavyweights like Michelle Obama to deliver the knockout punch. Now the fourth quarter in this game was about to start, and it started with the October 9th debate. Trump had a long memory, and the ones from the first debate stung and inflamed him and his campaign to come back in full attack mode. He could not forget the microphone malfunction, but most of all, he wanted to come back against Clinton and all the allegations that were being made against him about his crude treatment of women. While he took the high road in the first debate, this time he was going straight to the bottom. Assistant campaign manager Dave Bossie was an expert on Clinton scandals, and no scandals were more distasteful and disgusting than the ones that involved Bill Clinton while he was married to Hillary. For the sake of political expediency, Hillary used a combination of payoffs and threats to make the scandals go away, because staying in marriage while her husband flaunted his unfaithfulness made her look like she was either an accomplice or a helpless victim, neither of which was the right profile for a United States president. To rattle the Clinton campaign, Trump's campaign rolled out a rogues gallery of the main players of both Clinton's sexual scandals to attend the debate. There was Kathy Shelton, who was raped as a 12-year-old by 41-year-old Tom Taylor. Appointed as Taylor's attorney, Clinton suggested that Shelton was emotionally unstable, and her allegations could not be taken seriously. Also present was Juanita Broderick, who claimed that in 1978 she was raped by Bill Clinton. The third woman that they brought in was Kathleen Wiley, who said that she was sexually assaulted by then-President Clinton in the White House. Of course, there was Paula Jones, who the Clintons paid $850,000 to settle a 1994 sexual harassment case, as another Bill Clinton sex scandal, the Monica Lewinsky debacle, was unfolding. The second debate had somewhat of a town hall format where the candidates did not stand behind a podium to take questions from a moderator, but mingled among attendees who would ask them questions. The assortment of Clinton scandal personalities infuriated not only the Clinton camp and the mainstream media, but it had the desired effect. It blunted the expected impact of the Access Hollywood tapes and took away any momentum that Hillary Clinton had arising from the tapes. After the debate, the mainstream media and many conservatives still believed that Trump was headed to a historic loss. The term "measuring the White House for drapes" must have been the overriding sentiment in the Clinton camp, as most pundits declared that their question was not whether Hillary was going to win, but by how much. With 3 weeks to go in the campaign, Kellyanne Conway took Trump to task and told him that his comments about women, especially about Alicia Machado, were hurting his campaign. She said that to criticize things like how much women weighed went to the heart of the struggles of millions of women who struggle and suffer to lose weight. She also told Trump that he had to act like a winner in the coming days because there was no way that he was going to lose. Chapter 15. Fake News. Running against an experienced, formidable opponent is tough enough, but running against the mainstream media that was the deadest in wanting you to lose added to the already immense pressure on Trump and his campaign. Fake news not only meant that the media was fabricating or the out-of-proportion blowing-up news about Trump, But it also meant glossing over and even ignoring many Hillary Clinton scandals that would otherwise have been huge deals if Trump were involved in them. This included fundraising scandals, deleted emails, getting questions in advance during the debates, the Benghazi debacle, the list goes on. Most people would have withered under the one-sidedness of media coverage, but Donald Trump was not most people. He never backed off from anything, no matter how stacked the odds were against him. Trump had a secret weapon of sorts in the person of Corey Lewandowski. Even if he was fired as campaign manager in July, he continued to have an unofficial role in the Trump campaign, doing advance work and even traveling with the campaign to some events. However, he also had a paid position as a political commentator for CNN, something that many in the mainstream media resented because they believed, correctly, that he was an insider in the Trump campaign. In the netherworld of media bias, it is okay to have Clinton mouthpieces, former campaign heads, and Clinton apologists like David Axelrod and Paul Begala in CNN, but somehow it is verboten to have a Trump ally as a political commentator. Even if coverage and opining in CNN and the other networks were already overwhelmingly anti-Trump, the media wanted no part of any Trump supporter like Lewandowski. No matter what his critics said, CNN President Jeff Zucker kept Lewandowski on the payroll because he was good TV and was good for ratings. In the end, it was all that mattered. Whether it was debating Clinton campaign staff, or even former Trump ghostwriter and now Trump basher Tony Schwartz, Lewandowski came across as an articulate messenger for the Trump campaign. Zucker warned Lewandowski not to travel with the Trump campaign to remove all doubt about his objectivity, but he continued to hang around with the Trump campaign, but eventually resigned from CNN. In the final week of the campaign convinced Mrs. Trump, Melania, to have an interview with Anderson Cooper of CNN. The last week to the Trump campaign was do-or-die week, and the Melania Trump interview, together with the last-minute FBI report from Director Jim Comey, certainly helped the cause. The Clinton campaign, smelling victory, did not even bother to do polling during the week. On November 8, 2016, the greatest game day, the politician won in a stunning upset. Lewandowski called Trump the morning after to congratulate Trump, who told him that he could not have won without Corey. Corey then remembers the four-word reminder that he had put up on a whiteboard in the very first days of the campaign. It was the secret to the campaign's success. Let Trump be Trump. Chapter 16. Epilogue: The Transition. Winning was big, but of course it was only the start of the Trump era. There was still the matter of bringing a team to the White House for the actual business of the presidency. Everyone had to sober up quickly and get over the victory hangover. Even as the mainstream media paid a lot of attention to and applied pressure to the Trump campaign, the media focused on the first days of the selection of the new administration. Bannon somehow found a copy of the Romney Readiness Project, which was a startling revelation to everyone. Mitt Romney was already planning his transition and looking for people to fill the positions in transition, even as he was campaigning for the presidency. Trump had never looked beyond November 8, 2016, focusing on winning the election. Bossie would meet some of the candidates at Trump's estate in Mar-a-Lago, and he noted with disappointment that outsiders and even people who had criticized Trump during the campaign found themselves being considered for top jobs in the Trump administration. Renz Priebus, despite coming in late to the team and was not quite the all-out true believer through the entire campaign, headed the staffing effort. Trump followed Priebus' recommendation and took in Sean Spicer and Kate Walsh as presidential spokesman and deputy chief of staff, respectively. Spicer and Walsh were also surprise appointees because they had distanced themselves from Trump when things were going south in October. Chapter 17 In the Oval. Trump did not waste any time in acting on his promise to make America great again. When he was giving his inaugural speech, he knew exactly what the state of the nation was and was going to take steps to improve that state. Among his first moves were to excise the law of the worst effects of Obamacare, such as the tax penalties on people that did not have health insurance. In his most controversial act, he directed immigration authorities to impose a temporary ban on refugees that were coming from seven nations that were known to be sponsors of Islamic terrorism. While Obama had issued essentially the same orders a few years before, the mainstream media and their surrogates raised a firestorm, once again insinuating that Trump was a racist. In lesser executive orders, he directed federal agencies to promote excellence in historically black universities and colleges, promote the rule of law regarding U.S. waterways, and to restore federalism. A serious problem arose in the first few days of the Trump presidency. Someone, or some people, were leaking information to the press, and Trump was livid. He had had Rince Priebus vet everyone in the White House staff, including Bossie and Lewandowski. Eventually, the president could not trust even his chief of staff, and Rince Priebus was out less than 8 months after his initial appointment. The distrust and suspicions would continue, and Sean Spicer and Katie Walsh soon followed Priebus's exit. Anthony Scaramucci, a former Clinton supporter, was appointed by Trump to head his transition team and had a permanent position soon after the elections. Scaramucci, too, flamed out and left. Even Keith Schiller, Trump's bodyguard and friend for over 30 years, departed. In the end, the meat grinder that was the U.S. presidency left just a handful of the people who were in the trenches with Trump during the campaign. Lewandowski, who was in a roller coaster of a ride in the campaign, can only proudly say that he was Trump's campaign manager and no one could ever top that. Chapter 18 Conclusion Donald J. Trump draws out the most visceral responses from people. Either you totally love him, or you loathe him with every fiber in your body. There are very few who have no strong opinion about him either way. People who have dealt personally with him have emerged from their contacts with him either one of two ways. They have either been scarred for life or swear a blood loyalty to the Donald. He is a tough boss and drives people harder than most. To be immersed in the crucible of the pressures of a presidential campaign with Trump may be the toughest job in politics, or in any profession, for that matter. The authors, especially Corey Lewandowski, were shoulder to shoulder with the man whose trigger-itchy emotions and decision-making kept them on their toes practically every waking hour. And every waking hour is from their account, seemed like all of their 24 hours 7 days a week. Donald Trump would be the closest that they would come to work for a deathless vampire, no sleep, no eating, and working and strategizing every waking moment. But despite the stark portrayal of a man few people really know intimately, the main character of the story was the presidential campaign, its intensity, pressure, and the stakes involved, not only for the candidates, but especially for the people who toiled in the background. Whether brash types like Steve Bannon or strong, quiet types like Keith Schiller. The sheer scale of campaign operations, the money involved, the number of moving parts, and the people required speaks volumes about the incalculable desire of the candidates who would dare seek the position, as well as the motivation, ambition, and even craftiness and cunning of the thousands who sink several months of their lives into the grinder, that is a United States presidential campaign. Most work for the achievement of an ideal, progressiveness, conservatism, values, and whatever the candidates are selling. Half of them walk away in heartbreak after the process, hoping for a brighter day, knowing that another candidate in 4 years will once again light up their zeal to fight for their vision. For every jackal like a Paul Manafort, there are thousands of true believers like John McGinty, who lived and breathed Republican politics. They are all thrown in a combustible mix that somehow sputters along and delivers when it has to. This book is, of course, ultimately self-aggrandizing and self-promotional as the authors continue their careers as professional political consultants. There is also nothing but admiration for their boss, Donald Trump, which is fully expected of a campaign memoir. Even given all that, the authors still had to deal with a fearsome boss and a daunting endeavor that required nothing less than 100% effort and commitment. That the two authors were able to stick around for as long as they did is, for lack of a better word, amazing. You have been listening to Summary, Let Trump Be Trump, The Inside Story of His Rise to the Presidency, written by Readtrepreneur Publishing, narrated by Thomas Block. Copyright 2018 by Readtrepreneur Publishing. Production copyright 2018 by Readtrepreneur Publishing. To learn more about the world's best book summaries from all the best business and self-development books, visit the publisher's website at www.readtrepreneur.com. That is readtrepreneur.com. Also, please help us by leaving an honest review at Audible or Amazon. Thank you. This has been a production of Thomas Block Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.